Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And today, you might say our focus is the beginning of the end of the world blues. Play it, B.B. King.
I've been downhearted, baby, ever since the day we met.
B.B. King's How Blue Can You Get? We will say goodbye to B.B. King this hour, and note that we can get very blue thinking about the world these days. But we begin in the soft and non-threatening days of early 1979, when B.B. King was in his ripe mid-50s. The Cold War seemed to be warming up. Iran was our friend back then. It produced a Passover show for Iranian TV to reassure Jews about the future, just weeks before students would overrun the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and take hostages. There was a big agreement on trade reform, and this tune was the top song. Reunited, Peaches and Herb. Into all this tranquility dropped a low-budget movie. It wasn't a horror movie per se.
In the not-too-distant future, there will be no civilization. There will be no heroes.
It wasn't a political movie, really.
You should see the damage.
Bronze, huh? Metal damage.
Brain damage, huh?
Are you listening, Bronze?
I am the Knight Rider. I'm a fuel-injected suicide machine.
It was Australia's vision of a Wild West carved from the industrial breakdown of civilization. Humans fighting back with any rusty machine they could find. Mad Max, filmed by a doctor who staged the violence by using his knowledge from treating car crash victims. It had unknown actors, rusty police cars, people named Toe Cutter and Knight Rider, motorcycles and hacksaws. Mad Max became a cult classic, and it was for decades the world's most profitable film. Director George Miller wanted it to have the feel of a silent film, but unlike the apocalyptic Fritz Lang classic Metropolis, the machines would control nothing. It would be humanity's dependence on machines and what happens when they all break down that would drive this end-of-the-world vision. Mad Max started an end-of-world movie genre that is anything but fringe today, as the latest Mad Max, Fury Road, is released as a big-budget mainstream studio blockbuster.
Oh, what a day! What a lovely day!
Adam Sternberg is the author of the dystopian novels Shovel Ready and Near Enemy. Welcome, Adam.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did Mad Max begin, do you think, back in the late 70s?
I think it started this fascination we have with exactly what you were talking about, the breakdown of civilization. You know, in the sort of post-atomic age, the idea of a world wiped out was one that I think had really taken grasp of people's imaginations. But Mad Max looked at this idea of what have we built and what would happen if it all falls apart. And that's something that you see repeating again and again to today.
It's really kind of like an end of modernism, because Metropolis was really all about the machines taking over and what we've created mastering us. The Terminator is sort of a throwback in that sense. This is really just about what kind of junk could we put together to survive. And it was immediately plausible to people.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting if you look at the dystopian stories that sort of captured people's imagination through the 20th century. There's a real shift from the kind of early dystopias characterized by 1984 and Metropolis, which were about sort of society overgrown and bureaucracy run amok and totalitarianism and sort of ultimate control. And with Mad Max, you saw a shift toward a dystopian vision that was all about loss of control, societal breakdown, and sort of people having to live by these kind of ancient primitive survival skills, which I think many of us fear that we've lost touch with.
And now it's almost like a documentary. I mean, we have an intuitive sense that things are falling apart. We have an intuitive sense that we can't control what we've created. And we do have a sense that we're kind of improvising with junk that's laying around everywhere. Wouldn't you say?
Oh, sure. I mean, that vision of a world where people are fighting over oil and fighting over water, those are the kind of nightmare scenarios that persist to today. And I think it's telling that that movie came out in the late 70s when you did have the OPEC issue, you did have gas rationing in the U.S., and people started to wake up to the idea that this kind of era of bountiful resources and endless expansion might be coming to an end or might have consequences that we're all going to have to deal with.
But the mainstream view of OPEC was a conspiratorial one, a kind of trilateral commission behind the scenes controlling all of us. The real vision, the revolutionary vision, was Mad Max. And that's what we have today, that no, nothing can be controlled. We run out of this stuff and we humans are just running around like rats in the world. How does this influence your art, your literature?
Well, all of those sort of classic 70s dystopias are movies that I grew up with as a kid. And, you know, Mad Max was a hugely influential film, and you had all these sort of American movies that came out around the same time, like The Warriors and Escape from New York, which were similar sort of imaginings of a kind of post-civilization civilization.
Planet of the Apes is kind of everything falling apart.
Sure, yeah, Planet of the Apes, and you had these science fiction dystopias like Logan's Run and movies like that. And then also growing up in the sort of 70s and 80s, you were still at the tail end of the Cold War when the kind of idea of like planetary annihilation was sort of constantly in the back of your mind, even as a kid. And even though we're not as worried, rightly or wrongly, about that anymore, certainly that kind of ambient anxiety persists. It just seems to kind of be transferred from one new threat to another.
Do you think the mainstream quality of this dystopian vision, and it's an overused word now, which is also a sign of the revolution or the apocalypse, whatever you want to say, takes the sting out of the shock value that the original Mad Max has?
I think there's definitely a sense of dystopian fatigue in a way, although clearly these visions have a persistent power because we keep returning to them. I think what's interesting in some of the dystopian visions we see now, as opposed to Mad Max, which really was a kind of hard scrabble fight for survival, there was no real hope in that movie. It's basically one man kind of avenging his family. It's not like at the end of the movie you think, oh, okay, we're all going to be all right.
Right.
Whereas now I think there is a almost kind of fantasy element to a lot of dystopias because our lives have seemingly become so complex and we've become so reliant on different technologies that we barely understand. There's almost a kind of fantasy of, well, what if all that was stripped away and we'd get back to the sort of essentials, we'd get back to kind of interpersonal relationships, we'd get back to cooking our own food over fires and making our own clothes. And I do think that the dystopia has – the edge has been dulled a little bit because it's less a nightmare as it is a kind of alternate scenario of simplicity that has a sort of appeal to us now because we feel like things have become so complicated and difficult to understand.
So the 21st century is about the vegan apocalypse.
I do think there's a sense in which we think it wouldn't be so bad. I mean, there's a comedy on television right now called The Last Man on Earth, which sort of says something about how the idea of being the last person on Earth and kind of walking through this shopping mall that's completely empty and being able to take whatever you want for free, it's become a weird sort of fantasy that we indulge in, even as we worry about zombie plagues and super flus and stuff like that.
Do you have any sort of extra set of flashlights, any sort of just-in-case object that represents your little slice of Mad Max?
I do have a flashlight, and I will admit it's not only a flashlight, but it's one of those sort of heavy
mag lights. Yeah.
Because who knows, when the zombies come in the window, you might be able to brain a few of them.
For me, it's headlamps.
Yes.
Those camping headlamps. I have tons of them just sitting around.
See, I would think headlamp would be the last thing you'd want to wear because you're basically putting a beacon on your head saying, hey, here I am. Come hunt me down.
You've been there. You've thought
I've thought these things through.
Do you think we are in the apocalypse now, that essentially we are living in a time of uncontrol, and that this Mad Max Fury Road is almost a throwback? It's a bit of history. It's not even envisioning the future.
I definitely think it's a bit of social history. And I think it's funny that we're so obsessed with this dystopian vision of societal breakdown and sort of technological breakdown while we are simultaneously living in something that's very similar to the previous idea of dystopia of sort of constant surveillance, government overreach. I mean, the kinds of things that a the previous generations worried about are the kind of things we're actually facing. And yet we have seemed to have transferred all of our anxieties to a whole new set of circumstances that in a sense are probably just a distraction from how dystopian our lives have actually become.
Mad Max, one of its, you know, revolutionary visions was there were no presidents giving addresses. There were no trying to calm the nation from the government. The whole head of civilization had been cut off and thrown away. And I think we have that same kind of feeling that we would never look to those people for any reassurance anymore.
Oh, I think that's definitely true. And you often see in these dystopian visions, they've become much more a story of the common person's experience of the apocalypse as opposed to the president taking charge and telling everyone what to do. It really comes down to you, your family, and hopefully your broomstick or mag light that's going to, you know, beat back the apocalypse at your door.
Adam Sternberg, author of the novels Shovel Ready and Near Enemy. Thanks so much, Adam.
Thank you.
I'd like to be remembered as a friend. I'd like to be remembered as a guy who lived next door, loved people, and wanted to be loved by them.
Thrill is gone away, truly gone away. B.B. King has gone to join all the sweet little angels he sang about for most of a century. B.B. King spread his wings for the last time in Las Vegas on Thursday. He was 89, having been a working performer since the 1940s, a man who personified the blues since his big breaks in the 1950s. Born Riley B. King, he grew up on Mississippi gospel music and Memphis stomp. He took the name B.B. for Blues Boy and named his guitar Lucille after a bar brawl in Arkansas where two men died fighting over a woman named Lucille.
I was told that some of you dudes don't know anything about blues. That's what they told me, so I want to say this to you. I came to swap some with you. I imagine quite a few of you dudes have the blues already.
Lucille became a symbol of peace and peacemaking that far transcended the bar scene, a black Gibson guitar on which he never did the same riff twice.
I can't play what I played before. I guess I got a stupid head or stupid fingers. If I play something right now, I'd never play it again. Never play it again because I can't remember what I did.
King won more than two dozen Grammy Awards, influenced major guitarists of the era, Eric Clapton, Jimi Hendrix. He made blues mainstream by always speaking the truth and remaining humble.
Oh, you're gonna miss me, baby. And I'll be so far away.
Nothing more to say there. Blues legend B.B. King died yesterday at the age of 89.
You know you better change now, baby. Baby, there is always another day.
B.B., we miss you.
Oh, I want you to tell me that you love me, baby. And leave all of your no-good friends behind.
How do prominent court cases influence our understanding of human behavior? When lawyers get their hands on science and present it to a jury in life-or-death cases, and the results get offered up in wild and distorted headlines, does the truth get tossed out the window? That's the fear as a jury deliberates the fate of Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. Will he get life in prison or the death penalty? During the trial, Tsarnaev's defense team presented all sorts of mitigating factors against the death penalty, including that as a 19-year-old, Tsarnaev had an immature adolescent brain not fully capable of effective reasoning and decision-making, and especially open to the radicalizing influence of his late older brother, Tamerlan. Dr. Sally Satel, a psychiatrist and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, is co-author of the book Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. She says in this case, lawyers have stretched reality trying to turn mercy for a convicted killer into a matter of brain science.
The key to remember is that neuroscience has its place, and especially functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, it has a very secure place in the lab and to some extent in the clinic. It's when it migrates into the public square that things sometimes get a little bit overstated, or frankly, a lot overstated. And one of those domains into which neuroscience has migrated is the courtroom.
So do you begrudge the defense for grabbing at anything that would save him? I mean, is it scientifically invalid to just kind of throw the kitchen sink at the jury?
I certainly don't begrudge his strategists for doing that. But there are clearly people with deficiencies in their brain that make it extremely difficult for them to conform their behavior because of those problems. The question is, can brain imaging in the courtroom identify those people? And the answer is no. So far, even though they may be introduced, the answer is ultimately that it cannot show that unless the injury is just massive and also probably very acute. Take, for example, the case of Andrea Yates. It was the woman in 2001 in Houston who drowned her 5 children in the bathtub. She had a severe postpartum psychosis. She thought she was the devil, that she was infecting her children, that she had to kill them in order to save them. And she did. And then after she drowned them and lined them up on the bed, she called the police. And ultimately, she was declared not guilty by reason of insanity, which I certainly believe was the correct disposition. But at that time, there was no brain scan used in her defense. But had there been a brain scan taken at that time, chances are it wouldn't have shown anything particularly abnormal. Now, that's not because there wasn't something desperately abnormal with her brain, but either the instrumentation at the time right now is not sensitive enough to pick that up, various reasons. But the point is that it works both ways, that we can find things in the brain. For example, there was a now famous case of I think in the late 90s, of an executive in New York who pushed his wife out a window after he killed her, and to make it look like a suicide. And then in desperation, his lawyers thought, well, let's just send him for a brain scan. Maybe we can find something. And sure enough, they actually found a large, what was called subarachnoid cyst in his right orbital frontal lobe. And that seemed incredibly compelling. The scan showed this huge black void, and around it was compressed tissue. So his lawyers made the argument that the compressed tissue somehow made it impossible for him to understand the difference between right and wrong. And it actually turned out that this cyst was a completely incidental finding. And that what that means is that it didn't alter his behavior at all in any dimension. This doesn't mean that we won't get much better at using brain-based data, but right now it's still at a pretty primitive stage.
It just means that something that looks visually compelling may be persuasive to a jury, but it's dangerous to be out there in the public as some sort of a theory that might apply to other cases.
That's exactly right. In fact, the prejudicial significance of these scans has concerned some judges to the point where they won't let the defense show the scans. So they can describe them, for example. But, remember, again, this is when we talk about the teen brain, basically we're talking about the fact that the frontal lobe, which is an area associated with planning and control and inhibition, the fibers that it sends to another area of the brain that's involved with excitation and fear and aggression, that those inhibiting fibers haven't yet completely finished developing. So that could lead to a kind of disposition towards impulsivity. And then another part of the brain that modifies reward and motivation. And in teens, it's more sensitive than in adults. And the idea there is that it makes sensation seeking and the desire of peer approval an even more compelling prospect for teens.
And so the takeaway here would be maybe it's okay to theorize that his brother's influence on him, a phenomenon that is well established in psychological literature, could have had something to do with this crime. Whether or not it excuses him or not is another thing. And whether or not you need some kind of fancy brain imaging
evidence to enhance that theory is crossing a line and may be irresponsible as far as evidence in the courtroom is concerned. Is that about right?
Yes, I think it is an overstatement. I have no question that his brother did influence him significantly. The question is, was he able to reason and was he able to control himself? And there is nothing about the teen brain in general that indicates that a person is bereft of those faculties.
Sally Satel is a psychiatrist and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. She's co-author of a book called Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Friday, and we've come to the part of our program where we search for five fantastic things online, because Sean Ramaswaran is here, host of Sideshow, Studio 360 podcast about art you don't see in museums. He finds online what we can't find on our own. Sean, take it away. Number one.
Hi, John. On Monday, number one, I saw a tweet from this Iranian journalist, and it was the cover of a book on couples having sex problems.
Ooh.
How to fix your relationship. And it had a couple of random photos of men on it, but one of them was Tom York from Radiohead. And it just made me laugh. Weird cultural idiosyncrasies for some reason. Someone threw Tom York's face on the cover of this book, and you can see it on the internet at thetakeaway.org.
Were there riots in the streets as a result of this?
No, I don't think. We were placated by it, I think.
Glad to hear it. Number two.
Someone took the music out of the iconic warehouse dance scene in Footloose, where Kevin Bacon sort of gets out all of his anger through dance, and it sounds like this now.
Four minutes and 22 seconds of grunting.
You got to appreciate the sound design, though.
Yeah!
Because the guy had to sit there in his apartment and do this.
Oh, yeah!
It becomes like an indie art film, and it's still really compelling.
Well, you can do that with a lot of stuff.
Don't know. The internet does this with a lot of stuff. So this was kind of like, of course they did this scene. You had to do this scene. There's something called the Musicless Music Video as well, where they take like Bowie and Jagger doing Dancing in the Street, and it's just the sounds they would have been making, the diegetic sound, I think you'd call it.
And number three.
Owen Wilson says wow a lot, and now there's a supercut.
Wow, no wonder she wanted to leave.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow,
and how'd that affect you with guys?
Hey! Wow.
It's kind of a disappointment. I would think he would do better wows than
that. No, but the guy included like the what juxtaposes the wow, so you really get a full sense of his wonder
Wow-ness.
And awe, the sublime nature of the world as he sees it. I think it's sort of uplifting to see the world through Owen Wilson's wowing eyes.
Wow.
Wow.
Number four.
Wow.
Four times.
Number four. We've seen supercuts of Disney stealing from Disney before on the internet. You see like a dance from Sleeping Beauty in 1959, reused in Beauty and the Beast in 1991, or Snow White clapping in 1937 looks a lot like a character in Robin Hood clapping in 1973. But this week we got one in high definition, and you should check it out because it's funny to see these. Even a company as big as Disney has to cut some corners and recycle. It's great.
Recycling animation. I mean, it would just end up in a landfill somewhere.
Exactly.
It'd be horrible.
No, it's like California with the water, you know? You find a way to reuse it.
Fantasia. It's toxic.
Perfect.
Number five.
We did it!
Number five. This band Tame Impala is from Australia. They're wonderful. They plan on eventually dropping an album, I think sometime this summer. But every week for the past month, they've been teasing the album with one song. And the latest tease is this beautiful song called Eventually, and I brought it for you. Would you like to hear it? I feel like it's May now. The weather's starting to turn here in New York, and we need to start searching for our candidates for Song of the Summer candidates. And I feel like every song they've teased so far has been one with these sort of airy vocals and synthesizers. So I feel like I'm waiting for this album. It'll eventually come. And in the meantime, they can keep putting out these breakup songs that sound like summer anthems, and I'll be all on board.
And your relationship's all good?
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
No breakups?
We'll
see.
Yeah.
It's early yet.
Yeah.
Sean Ramaswaran, host of Sideshow, a Studio 360 podcast about art you don't see in museums.
But she's going to break up with me now.
Oh. Such a beautiful song. What is on the podcast this week, by the way?
It's the wonderful story of two comedians in Brooklyn who opened up a Tonya Harding Nancy Kerrigan Museum.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So we're at halftime here at The Takeaway. You want to stick around for the second half, of course. A reminder, we are on Twitter at The Takeaway. Please do follow us there. And you can follow me at Jay Hockenberry. I'll answer your tweets. What you're listening to is really only made possible by those who contribute to public radio. If you do, thank you. If you don't, please think about giving whatever you can to your local public radio station. They need it, and you'll feel good about being part of a community that values stories like this.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
It's Friday when we talk about films. Christian Meinzer joins us, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome, fellows.
Hey.
Hi, John.
Hey.
Fellows and girl. let's take you right to Mad Max Fury Road.
How do you know this place even exists?
I was born there.
So why'd you leave?
I didn't. I was taken as a child. Stolen.
Much bigger than the original Mad Max, much more fun than the original Mad Max, Rafer?
Well, yeah, the original Mad Max was a pretty angry film. My favorite of the series is, of course, The Road Warrior. That's the iconic movie to me. This is the first one in 30 years, the first one since Beyond Thunderdome, and I think George Miller is determined to not be your grandfather's action director and make a creaky old action film. And I think he just goes all out. It's a lot of fun, completely wild. It's unlike anything he's done before. The visuals are spectacular. The stunts are great. Not super coherent, but I think it's a great wild ride.
Love the cast here.
Oh, yeah. Charlize Theron as Furiosa. We have Tom Hardy as Mad Max. And, you know, as far as what you're saying about it being cohesive or understandable, Rafer, I have to disagree, because the only thing you have to follow is this is just one chase scene.
That's
it. Is essentially a chase scene that goes for 2 straight hours. And I have to say it was a lot of fun. It's scary. I think this is a very post-apocalyptic, terrifying image of the future. People are essentially animals. Civilization is broken down on such an extreme level. No water, no oil, nothing. And people are fighting for whatever little bits are left. And people are just scary in this movie. The humans are the scariest part. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was incredible.
Nice. Miller used Ford Furies in the original.
Yes.
To his cars. Any product placements worthy of note here?
None that I could see. It's a lot of custom-made skull steering wheels.
Right. You probably wouldn't want to have your product placed in this movie. Pitch Perfect 2. This has got to be a good one.
Bart and Bellas, you came here to see us? Is it because you are, what do the American kids say, jelly?
Okay, we didn't come here to start something with you guys. We just wanted to check you out before the world's where we're going to kick your ass.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. You? You are the kicker of ass?
Yeah.
You are so tiny. Like an elf.
Feminine meets choir. Choir class meets revenge film. What do you think, Kristen?
Well, we're continuing to follow the Bard and Bellas, this college a cappella group of ladies who overcame the odds in the first movie. This time they have to go onto the international stage. That's the big enemy, Das Sound Machine, that they're fighting with right
das
there.
Das Sound Machine, there, yeah.
There's lots of singing, obviously. There's lots of bonding. It doesn't sparkle quite as much as the first. There are some race jokes in particular that fall sort of flat, but there are some great cameos, especially John Hodgman and Barack Obama. So
oh, really?
It's a lot of fun.
And don't forget the Green Bay Packers doing some a cappella country as well, which is fun. I think there are some really inspired moments in this, but I have to say, the ethnic jokes, the endless ethnic jokes, really bugged me. And I felt that it was a very strange thing to include in this film, which is otherwise very sweet-natured. I didn't know why they were there, and I thought a lot of them were very mean-spirited. And that kind of ruined the fun for me.
What was it all about?
Well, there's a lot of jokes about one particular Bard and Bella newcomer is a Guatemalan. And really all she ever does is make jokes about the grinding poverty of her country. At the end of the film, she announces rather blithely, well, I'll probably be deported, which just seems like a really callous wisecrack to make. And there's a lot of humor like that, Indians, Koreans, and it just doesn't belong in this movie, but it really bugged me.
testing humor that doesn't necessarily fly in Pitch Perfect 2. All right, what's on the podcast, Kristen?
We're launching a new feature called Mystery Date, where we look at those movies that are pushed on you by Netflix, by Hulu, the movies that we don't even know what they are, and we watch one and figure out what it's about.
All right. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, the new feature, Mystery Date. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks,
you
John.
You too, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway.
This should just take a minute.
Thank you for calling Universal Helpful Services. We are committed to making your experience the very best it can be.
Oh, well, of course.
Please enter your zip code and thank you for your patience.
Uh-huh, no problem there. Dun, 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 dun.
If you have a question about hours and directions to your nearest Universal showroom, press 1.
Nope.
If you know the extension for your Universal Helpmate, dial it now. If you have questions about your bill or want to pay your bill, press 2. If you are noticing seizure activity in one of your children while using our products, please stay on the line for the next available operator.
What?
And thank you for your patience. If it's none of these options, then it doesn't matter what you press. Ha 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 ha.
Many of us go to an end-of-the-world place virtually every day. It's called the land of automated customer service, where you do all the work and get thanked for your patience. We pump our own gas, we assemble our own furniture, we book our own flights, and bag our own groceries at the supermarket. In the office, we track our own vacation and sick days, organize and clean out our inboxes, sort our receipts, and file our own expense reports. Unpaid shadow jobs, work we do without thinking, tasks that big corporations don't have to pay people to do anymore. Pretty nice for them, huh? Craig Lambert has a term for these tasks, which are the subject of his new book.
The term I use is shadow work for all of these unpaid jobs that we're doing now on behalf of organizations, businesses, schools, hospitals, all kinds of even nonprofits. And they do chip away at our leisure time. The free time is becoming an endangered species.
Self-serve gasoline changed my life because if you're in a wheelchair, there's no way you can get out of the car and do the gas pumping, and you have to find a full service gas station, or else forget it. You will run out of fuel. And I've been in that situation. Why did it seem so intuitive that self serve was somehow more convenient in some sense?
Well, it can save you time. You don't have to wait for an attendant to process your transaction. You can do it on your own when you will with the robotic pump. There was a newer type of technology, the robotic gasoline pump, which has been improved over the decades, that allowed people to take care of themselves. And then that also opened up the chances of laying off the old-fashioned pump jockeys who used to pump the gas and take your windshield and clean it and check your oil. Those days are pretty much over. And what shadow work often does is it removes a human being from the equation. We wind up doing it ourselves with a kiosk or a robotic device like the gasoline pump.
The airlines are a place where this has really taken hold. I mean, it seems like almost everything that I used to do with a human has some machine component right now. And there are often flights where I don't even have to interact with a human at all until I get on the plane.
That's right. We'll wind up checking in with a kiosk instead of an agent. We'll print our boarding pass at home, first of all, using our own printer, our own ink, our own time, instead of having the airline do it at the terminal. And many places are now asking the traveler to take care of their own luggage tags, and that can backfire sometimes.
In grocery stores, we rely more and more on our knowledge of the sort of roadmap of the store to find stuff. There's often no clerk to really ask, and if you do find someone, they don't necessarily know where anything is. How has that evolved?
There was a time, almost 100 years ago, before the current supermarket model came on, where the customer would be in the middle of the store, and there were goods stacked on shelves all around the sides, and there were salespeople, and you would ask them, you know, could I have a pound of sugar? Could you get me a can of baked beans? And they would give it to you. They'd hand each one to you. before 1916 when Clarence Saunders invented in Memphis the modern supermarket model. But you look at big box stores, if you go wandering through the aisles of Target or Staples, trying to find a salesperson is hello, hello. You know, it's sort of like I say in the book, it's like, you know, going through the Yukon Territory looking for a human settlement. Very few people, and that means we have become effectively the salespeople.
Customer service, is that an oxymoron now, or has automation produced an experience where, you know, you don't get any service and you're never going to talk to anything other than a robot?
That has been very much brought into the phone trees, the templates, the menus that we have to punch through. There are infuriating things like you call up and the first question the robotic voice asks you is, what is your account number? And then you go through a few more hoops and wait a while. And then finally, when a customer service agent comes on the phone, the first thing they ask you is, what is your account number? Which you wonder.
Which drives me crazy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why am I being asked this if I already punched it in? In the old days, somebody would answer the phone and say, how can I help you? Right away. That may seem like something from Mars now.
Why would we expect that that situation would be the norm? I mean, why – the premise of your book is that on some level this is a distortion of the way things ought to be. And in fact, I'm wondering if it's such a moving target that that's a suspicious assumption to make.
Well, I would hesitate to use the word ought, but I do provide a benchmark by going back to the 1950s and 60s when I was a young person and the kind of lifestyle that we lived then before shadow work. When in sports, I played sandlot sports. There were never any adults present, only us kids, and we decided where the field was and where the markers were, and we'd made our own calls. And now there's an army of shadow working adults coming out there and blowing whistles and wearing black and white striped shirts and coaching and raising sponsorship money and running the whole show, essentially, in a very organized way. And I don't think, you know, progress is simply a linear march forward. I think some things are getting lost, and we may not be able to go back to some of these other things. They may be lost to our dismay.
One of the most compelling arguments you make in this book is, and once you hear it, you can't get it out of your mind. We accept that it is our responsibility to commute, that we do this for our employers every day. It takes hours and hours, and we're completely happy, and we would no more charge our employers for the cost of our commute than we would, I don't know, burn down a church. I mean, it just seems like an immoral kind of request to make. But when you think about it, what is the reason for that?
Well, commuting, as you're absolutely right, is so woven into our lifestyles. Particularly since the automobile, but even before that, there was an era when there was no commuting, when people worked at home in the colonial times. Everyone did housework all the time just to keep their house sustained. And now it's a huge time and money hog. Some of my stats show that the average commute is 16 miles each way. At the current reimbursement rates, that winds up to be about $4,400 a year, as well as the amount of time it takes. I worked it out that if you converted it into full-time work, it would be the equivalent of 5 full-time work weeks, 40-hour weeks per year, just spent commuting. And it's not necessarily very productive time. Yet we do totally accept it. It's an indication of the way we value money versus time. My book is trying to speak up for time and saying that time is something of infinite value. It's precious. Beyond any measure. Money is valuable. We all like money, but it's finite in its value, and whereas time cannot be put on a yardstick or a metric. And I think we've started to overlook how important time is, and it's being eroded gradually by shadow work and other forces that nip away at our leisure.
Craig Lambert is author of Shadow Work, The Unpaid, Unseen Jobs That Fill Your Day. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And here's something to take with you today. B.B. King's guitar was named Lucille, the original, a $30 Gibson. But he didn't have just one guitar. He called them all Lucille every time he bought a new one. Then in 1980, Gibson made a guitar called the Lucille, which cost a few hundred dollars. And now there was a Lucille flood. You can find Lucilles signed by B.B., played by B.B., touched by B.B. King in clubs and bars all over the world.
And on eBay today, there is a signed Gibson Lucille, the King of Blues guitar, in the case, in pristine condition, on sale for $22,000. Can't make any more of those anymore. That's all for today. You can respond to anything you heard on today's program. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. Ask me anything on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints, and do my best to get back to you personally. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.